Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Rachman Review. I'm Gideon Rachman, Chief Foreign Affairs Commentator of the Financial Times. This week, we're looking at Lebanon, a year on from the blast that devastated Beirut, the country's capital city. The explosion was caused by tons of ammonium nitrate, which had been left to fester in the port. And that official negligence has become a symbol for decades of misgovernment. My guest is Chloe Cornish, the FT's correspondent in Lebanon, who's just written a powerful magazine piece chronicling the country's economic, political, and social crisis. So can anything halt Lebanon's slide into disaster? When I started my journalistic career in the 1980s, Lebanon was engaged in a 15-year civil war and was rarely out of the international news. Israel invaded in 1982. The bombing of the US Marine barracks in 1983 killed 299 American and French soldiers.
I know there are no words that can express our sorrow and grief over the loss of those splendid young men and the injury to so many others.
And over 100 foreign hostages were taken by a variety of militias during the 1980s. The efforts to free the hostages meant that Lebanon was big news in the West. But a peace accord ended the civil war in 1990, and the last hostages were released in 1992. Lebanon's seen plenty of drama and violence since then, including the assassination of a prime minister, Rafik Hariri, in 2005, and further conflict with Israel in 2006. But the country's been displaced in the international headlines by other, even more dramatic stories in the region. The invasion of Iraq in 2003, the revolution in Egypt in 2011, and the outbreak of the civil war in Syria that same year. The numerous dramas and tragedies across the Middle East has meant the unfolding disintegration of Lebanon has not got the attention that it would once have attracted. So, a year on from the blast, I asked Chloe Cornish how far Beirut has recovered.
You do see some recovery, like a lot of private businesses have spent that money to fix up their restaurants, their bars, and in some of these places, nightlife has returned. There's this indomitable kind of will to keep going. But a lot of that was done on private initiatives, charitable donations helped, and the government really has not taken a big share of the responsibility there. What I would say is, though, if superficially on the surface, some of these places look like vaguely recovered, the port itself is still a total catastrophe. And these are all what I'm talking about, just what you can see deep inside people. Those scars from the disaster are going to go on probably their whole lives. And there are people with injuries who will be affected by those forever. And there are people who lost loved ones who will never get them back. And they haven't had any answers from officials about who was responsible for the deaths of their sons, daughters, wives, husbands. You know, it's that kind of grief and mourning can't be fully processed without really knowing why it was that your loved one died. And those kinds of scars and wounds, people I don't think will ever recover from those, you know, without having some answers.
And of course, as well as the elements of physical recovery, rebuilding that you talked about, there is a sort of background political and economic crisis. And one of the things that really jumped out in your piece was you quoted the World Bank as saying that Lebanon, if I'm getting this right, is now potentially one of the three most severe crises globally since the mid-19th century. What did they mean by that and what were they pointing at?
Yeah, that is pretty extraordinary, isn't it? To think that in 150 years, this could turn out to be one of the worst economic crises proportionally that the world has actually seen. But yes, this is an extremely serious and debilitating financial and economic crisis. And one of the things that the World Bank has actually emphasized in its reports on Lebanon over the last few months is how far that crisis is the fault of Lebanon's own leaders. They've termed this the deliberate depression here in Lebanon because of the failure to act by the political class to avert or mitigate this sort of multi-layered financial and economic disaster. 50% of the country, or somewhere around that, is estimated to have fallen into poverty now. I mean, this is an extraordinary thing to have happened. And yet, there was still no action by the political class, despite the fact that they knew that half of the country was now living below the poverty line. And that's what's making it such a big and intractable problem, because nobody is actually taking real, concrete and useful measures to solve these crises.
We'll get onto the politics and the lack of political responsibility in a second, but just give me a sense, I mean, either statistically or, you know, in terms of what you see around you, of how this economic and financial crisis is working out.
In practice, there's some very real, tangible signs of this crisis. I mean, if you go to the doctor and you get told that you need a prescription of some kind of antibiotic or something like that, nowadays people, they're not just looking through three or four pharmacies, they're having to try to get that medicine from abroad at massive cost because there's just simply not medicine available now. And that's to do with complications around financing imports. The national electrical grid is more or less worthless currently. I mean, we're getting a few hours of electricity a day at best. Huge amount of electrical generation is being done by private generators. And they're also increasingly finding that they don't have the fuel that they need. So we're even being rationed on the amount of electricity we can use that we buy from private generators. And that's for those of us who are lucky enough to be able to afford to have a private generator. Now, you imagine what this is doing to businesses. How can you really take off as manufacturers if you don't have enough electricity? You know, one of the strange things is that this crisis has been caused partially by a banking meltdown. That's meant that people haven't been able to get their money out of the bank, so they don't have access to those savings at the true value at which they put those savings into the bank. So say they put in $1,000 in savings, they would only be able to withdraw that money as Lebanese lira, which is depreciating extremely rapidly. I mean, we're talking about like 10% swings in a day sometimes. So if you think about the way that you would expect people to be able to look after themselves in a time of crisis, especially middle-class people, that's really been taken away.
How much of the problems of Lebanon a reflection of the region that it's in? I mean, has it been destabilized by the fact that, as you say, it borders Syria, that Israel is kind of in a state of undeclared war with Hezbollah, which is such a dominant force in Lebanon? How much have the regional problems contributed to the crisis in Lebanon itself?
It's a really good and valid question, and it is something that many analysts will point to as not just a contributing factor, but maybe one of the kind of fundamentals underlying this whole mess is that Lebanon's in a really difficult neighborhood with a lot of big players around it. After its civil war ended in 1990, it was occupied by the Syrian military until 2005. So this kind of current political system that's developed really was brought in under the aegis of Hafez al-Assad, the former president of Syria, and then to a shorter extent, his son Bashar al-Assad, who then became president. There was also a long occupation of southern Lebanon by Israel that was a major, major factor in Hezbollah becoming a force. Hezbollah was created in response to that occupation in the 1980s. But I think we can't fall into a trap of simply attributing these problems to those regional factors. Because if there had been strong, honest governance in Lebanon by leaders who had Lebanon's best interests at heart rather than their own, this wouldn't necessarily have had to happen. We could have had a much better run country.
Yeah. So let's get to what was the heart of your really excellent piece, which I would recommend to anyone listening, which was a kind of indictment of the leadership of the country, many of whom you interview and many of whom have been around for decades. Why has Lebanon's leadership failed so badly?
So one thing that strikes you when you are starting to think about who are these men and what are their backgrounds, many of them were active leaders of militias during the civil war, which ran from 1975 to 1990 and was then settled by the so-called Taif Accords, which helped to demobilize the militias, apart from Hezbollah, which was deemed to be providing an essential service, actually, in holding back the Israelis in the south. So that was one of the reasons that the writers of the Taif Accords allowed Hezbollah to keep its weapons while they demobilized every single other militia, was because Hezbollah was seen to be protecting the nation. So yeah, that demobilized the militias. And it's been described by some writers as the militia leaders simply swapping their fatigues for suits and going into government. So a lot of the baggage that came out of the civil war came with these people into a new system of government. There was a lot of concern about making sure the power was in some way divided between Lebanon's sects. There are 18 sects, but the Taif Accords divided parliamentary representation between them. This wasn't supposed to be the end game. I mean, this was supposed to be a temporary kind of solution to try to stabilize and give representation to all the sects after the war, but it's just basically remained in stasis because those guys who came in as leaders didn't want to let go of power, which is something that we see all over the world, but was particularly, I think, particularly exacerbated here by the fact that there was a lot of fear between members of different sects. So the leaders of these parties became these chiefs. So patronage networks were built using the state's resources, whether that was by handing out government jobs or by making sure that your friends who were contractors got like a nice road building contract or whatever. I'm being hypothetical. I don't know a particular road building contract, but so that was used to strengthen their hands as well. And it made it increasingly difficult for any true opposition figures to make any impact on the Lebanese political scene.
So what you're describing is a very, very ossified political system in which people are dug in, as you point out, they're very old, they represent interests and sects which seem to be immovable. But presumably there must have been people of ability or patriots or whatever trying to reform the system. What happened to them? Why couldn't they make any headway?
That's certainly true. There's been not only politicians, but academic journalists, that kind of, you know, all these sorts of forces who have tried. And from the outside, Lebanon often looks like a quite a free place. You know, there's free media, quote unquote, and it seems like people have freedom of expression. But when you look at the recent history, you know, that there isn't real freedom if you think that you might be killed for the things that you're saying, right? Like there were so many assassinations of political figures, journalists, security officials during the 2000s and past 2010, that you couldn't be sure that being, you know, that if you were in political opposition, the chances, or even in somebody who opposed the way the system was going, you could really find yourself dead. I mean, one of the quotes from that story that I still can't stop thinking about really is Ronnie Shatter, who is the son of a former finance minister who was assassinated in a big car bomb. I asked Ronnie, why is it that there aren't many heroes in the story of Lebanon? Because this is a population with extraordinarily talented and gifted people. So why is it that, you know, nobody's managed to solve these crises? And he said, well, do they end up dead? You know, the people who dare to stick their necks out, dare to put their heads above the parapets, are at much higher risk of being killed here than they would be in France or England or somewhere like that. So I think that's really important to remember, that the threat of violence has kept this political system really paralyzed from evolving and reforming. And there's been so many vested interests with access to arms and money and regional allies that you can see that the odds were just absolutely stacked against anyone who wanted to change things.
And as you say, there's violence on all sides. But reading your piece, one of the things that really struck me was your emphasis on the centrality of Hezbollah as, if not the key, really, really central to the current situation.
Yeah, I think that, as we mentioned before, The Ta'if Accords allowed Hezbollah to keep its weapons. Hezbollah had a real reason for being then. It's really hard to deny that, I think. So it maintained its hold here, but it also expanded a huge amount, not always in ways that people find evil. I think this is really important to emphasize. Like, Hezbollah has a huge social function amongst the community that support it, which is Shia Muslims in general. But it also was very smart and made alliances with the biggest Christian party too. So that helped Hezbollah have a political cover, if you like. So Hezbollah tactically did something very clever there. But the problem is that it's so powerful that nobody could really challenge it. And it's not transparent either. It's not that we can say, okay, Hezbollah did this, that, and the other, because it chooses to operate behind the scenes a lot of the time. So Hezbollah, for example, controls the health ministry in Lebanon, which has been under like a great deal of scrutiny during coronavirus. Actually, for quite a long time, a lot of people I spoke to a few years ago, so before I started covering Lebanon really seriously, they said they felt that Hezbollah was the least corrupt of the parties, and that actually, you know, maybe Hezbollah was running the health ministry quite well. But those sorts of impressions seem to have been really dented as more allegations of corruption have emerged about Hezbollah and Hezbollah affiliates or officials. And also, as Hezbollah has become more involved in overseas adventurism, so it is a key ally of Syria's Bashar al-Assad, and it sent fighters to fight in the Syrian civil war. So this sort of expansionism and the growth of its international criminal networks and the growth of its missile armory has really alarmed Israel and the US, Israel's most important ally. And that obviously puts Lebanon in a really difficult position vis-a-vis the rest of the world. It's hard to talk about Lebanon without recognizing that as the elephant in the room. Hezbollah has a huge influence and role here, even if it's not always fully stated. The fact that Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, invited Hezbollah official to a big powwow he held with all of Lebanon's leaders to try to get them to form a government shows you that, you know, France accepts that Hezbollah is a very important part of the Lebanese political picture. And while it remains the only non-state armed actor, it has a fear influence, right? Like, no one else who's playing this game can say, you know, I have a militia to bring to this, or I have the backing of Tehran, or, you know, the backing of Syria.
You mentioned there the backing of Tehran. How much is Hezbollah able to act independently of what the Iranians want?
There's so many parts to this organization, right? Like, it's got its social functions, its military functions, its political functions. I don't think all of those are dictated by Tehran. And I think it has a lot of, like, operational independence. But it's important to remember that, you know, the IRGC has been alongside Hezbollah for so many years.
That's the Iranian Revolutionary Guards.
Yes. So it's absorbed so much of those teachings. And when I've spoken to Hezbollah officials, they are always very open about their relationship with Iran. You know, they tell you completely straight, like, we take money from Iran. You know, we get a lot of cash support from that country. But also they stress on the fact that they know what they're doing. You know, like, Hezbollah knows what it's doing. This is its community. This is its area, its country. Yeah.
Yeah, it's obviously an important relationship. So just to round up, I mean, the picture you paint now and in the article is a very, very bleak one. As you sit in Lebanon, is it possible to feel that there's any hope of the situation turning around and getting better? Or do you, in fact, fear that, on the contrary, it's poised to get worse?
A new prime minister designate was appointed not too long ago after Saad Hariri gave up trying to form a new government. I mean, one of the key things that Lebanon is suffering here is the fact that it doesn't have an empowered government currently. Its government is caretaker, and it needs a new government to do all of those things, like try to negotiate a bailout. Even if it manages to get a new government, which it hasn't had for a year now, that new government will have a massive, massive task. The international community is having a difficult time finding ways to support Lebanon, because it knows that the people in power are not to be trusted. Well, that's the overwhelming impression. So this government's going to have to find a way to garner enough confidence that it could get an IMF bailout. The International Monetary Fund has said that it's ready to help Lebanon, but it needs to obviously have a government to negotiate with. So then let's say they get the bailout. The terms of the bailout are going to be extremely onerous. Like, they're going to have to be able to prove that they're doing reforms in order to unlock money. There's no way that Lebanon's going to get free money anymore. So that's going to require them to properly govern. I mean, wow, like, that's not something that happens very much in like the history of Lebanese governance, like since the civil war. So can it manage that? Well, that's a really to be seen. In the meantime, we still don't have a government. The local currency continues to flop around wildly on the black market. People are just getting poorer and poorer. And the only people who are doing fine in this situation are those who have access to hard currency, fresh dollars, as it's now called in Lebanon, because we have so many different types of money here now. But money that you receive from abroad is called fresh dollars. So those who have access to fresh dollars, which are primarily people who were rich before anyway, are having a great time because prices of everything for them are very affordable. But everyone else who is still living off lira or the Lebanese pound has seen their quality of life just plummet. And that's if they can afford to buy food and shelter and stuff. And increasingly, my friends say they just want to see the whole thing raised to the ground and start over again. And that, I think, reflects a deep, deep sense of hopelessness. And yeah, my fear, and I think the fear of many people who care about Lebanon, is that those who can leave will all leave, and there won't be that drive for change. I'm really hopeful that there are still individuals who, like Lara Sabra, for example, who I interviewed for the piece, just extraordinary energy, determination, courage to try to keep challenging what's effectively a regime that's been holding the country hostage. So those sorts of people, hats off to them, absolutely incredible, their passion, energy, drive to see things change. And I just hope that history sort of favors them in the end. But like right now, today in Beirut, I'd say that was a very optimistic forecast.
Okay, well, look, Chloe, thank you for at least attempting to end on a note of optimism, and look after yourself. That was Chloe Cornish in Beirut, ending this edition of the Rachman Review. Thanks for listening, and please join me again next week.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about AI and the business travel sector. I speak to Tim LaBelle, head of product for SAP Concur Spend Solutions.
We'll have so much data that our travel will be safer.
Shelley Fletcher-Bryant, VP of Advito.
AI can certainly contribute to more eco-friendly travel practices.
And author and public speaker, Theo Lau.
AI can help us predict when it will be a peak travel, more delays, cancelled flights.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.